So the Bhagavad Gita is very significant. It is said that the Bhagavad Gita contains the essence of all Vedic scriptures, but that's not everything. It says whatever you may find in the different Vedic literatures, you will also find in the Bhagavad Gita. And then it says, but in the Bhagavad Gita, you still find a little more. Therefore, you may as well read Bhagavad Gita. Why go to all the trouble of reading all the Vedic literatures? If we think of the Vedic literatures, we should think of this room and all the walls covered in books, right? Full of dust, etc., that you take off shelves and you open them up, and after a while you wind up with little round glasses from reading endlessly one page after another. And by reading Bhagavad Gita, all the purposes of the Vedas can be fulfilled very easily, and still more. Therefore, let's read Bhagavad Gita. So this evening, we're reading from the Bhagavad Gita, from the sixth chapter, which is called Jnana Yoga. And this is not just any other translation of the Bhagavad Gita. This is Bhagavad Gita as it is. Everyone and his brother in India has given a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, and plenty of people in the West also. There was one dentist in Bombay who gave a commentary where he explained that Arjuna was like the patient and Krishna was like the doctor. And in this way, the whole discussion is taking place between the patient and his doctor. A cheap way to advertise his business, I must say. The Bhagavad Gita certainly is a little more profound than that. So here we approach the Bhagavad Gita as it is. This is the Bhagavad Gita by one, translated by one, and explained by one whose life was non-different from the Bhagavad Gita, and whose very life was the Bhagavad Gita itself. That was Srila Prabhupada. Such a person is known as a Mahabhagavat, or a person whose entire life illustrates the essence of Gita, and therefore whatever he does is like the Gita. One time Prabhupada was giving a lecture and he was speaking about the Gita, and someone in the audience asked, said, is Jeanne d'Arc, you know, that lady in France, who somewhere in the Middle Ages, Jeanne d'Arc, is she also in the Bhagavad Gita? And Prabhupada said, eh? You want to see Jeanne d'Arc in the Bhagavad Gita? And she said, Jeanne d'Arc, you know Jeanne d'Arc? And Prabhupada said, yes, Jeanne d'Arc also, because actually the life of all saintly personalities is part of the Bhagavad. Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. In fact, we find there in the Bhagavad Purana, we find many descriptions of saintly personalities. So in that way, one can count even the lives of great devotees as also being Bhagavad. Why not? He said. So now we read text 25. Sanae sane rupare man bhuja driti grihitaya atma samstam manakritva nakinchita pichintayet. Translation. Gradually, step by step, one should become situated in trance by means of intelligence sustained by full conviction, and thus the mind should be fixed on the self alone and should think of nothing else. So, purport. By proper conviction and intelligence, one should gradually cease sense activities. This is called pratyahara. The mind, being controlled by conviction, meditation and cessation from the senses, should be situated in trance or samadhi. At that time, there is no longer any danger of becoming engaged in the material conception of life. In other words, although one is involved with matter, as long as the material body exists, one should not think about sense gratification. One should think of no pleasure aside from the pleasure of the Supreme Self. This state is easily attained by directly practicing Krishna consciousness. So, we have just come to a section of the Bhagavad Gita which is describing yoga. Yoga not referring to some gymnastics. I don't know how it is on the radio here in Sweden, but where I am from, in the early morning, they had one man who was playing piano, and you get like this tune, dun, 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 and one, two, three, and stretching now, and up we go, and bow down, and dun, and forward and backward and lean to the right and lean to the left, and meanwhile playing piano. And many housewives used to practice on this, you know, even while vacuum cleaning, and vacuum to the right and to the left and like this. But then that became sort of outdated, you know, outdated. You're still doing gymnastics. Come on, you know, you're not doing yoga yet. Oh, I'm doing already yoga for years, right? Yoga became a fashion, and everyone and his dog was doing yoga. Sit up straight, breathe in deep, and the dog was breathing deep and breathing out like this. Everyone did yoga. It was becoming a household item. But the purpose of yoga, that was lost somewhere in between everything, underneath all the whatever it was. No one kind of knew anymore. What is the purpose of yoga? Well, so that you get fit, so that you can concentrate better. Well, you know, just be more, a better performance, a better general performance, right? That's what I get out of my yoga, you know. I mean, less stress and all these things, but this is also not the purpose of yoga. So here, the Bhagavad Gita then begins to speak about a more mystical aspect of yoga. It begins to speak about meditation and trance. Ah, trance. Yes, we've seen that also on television. People sitting and floating above the ground, sitting on nail beds, or walking over big fire beds in the Philippines in trance. Maybe you have heard of the Kumbh Mela. The Kumbh Mela is the biggest gathering in the world, right? Bigger than the biggest football match is the Kumbh Mela, which is a religious festival where at the peak at least 12 million people come in one spot, and they have camps, etc. So one can imagine what quite a group, 12 million in just one area, and they're all going to take bath in the holy river. So at that time it is a religious gathering, and in the Kumbh Mela all the yogis that are there, they appear, and one can see amazing things. I have seen a yogi with his head dug in the ground, and he was not an ostrich, but he was doing some sort of meditation like that, and he was indeed dug in with his head in the ground, and we were timing it, 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. Maybe someone should dig him up, right? But after about half an hour, the yogi just pulled his head out and no problems. He was still in good condition. So such yogis are there who can enter into trance. And we may think that this is quite a feat, quite a feat. Lots of people would be interesting to come and take pictures of that, right? To send home to mom. That would be interesting. Just traveling in India now, you know, click. So how did he do it? Very simple. He was bringing the ingoing air and the outgoing air into a balance called kumbhaka. And if you can bring your ingoing air and outgoing air in kumbhaka, you can enter into a trance and stop to breathe. It's not as hard as you think it is. Yogis can easily do it. There are stories of yogis who have voluntarily been dug under the ground and stayed there for a few weeks. They interviewed one such yogi and asked him what he thought about it. Why are you doing this, sir? Why are you letting yourself be put under the ground for 3 weeks? It's a great feat, you come out alive, but why are you doing this? He said, this material world is all illusion, and it is very dangerous. One can very quickly fall prey to all kinds of forms and think that they can be enjoyed, but that is not possible. Therefore, I better stay safe, and I stay in this box dug under the ground. Yes, So the yogi was not a fool because he understood something. He understood that in this world there are many, many forms that are enticing us and that look really good. It looks great. But is it so great? In India, I saw a drawing. It was a little serious. It was a drawing of a frog. So what's so serious about a frog? Well, this particular frog was in a somewhat precarious condition because a snake had crawled up from the back and it had half swallowed the frog. And you may have never seen this in Stockholm, but on TV, right? They swallow them whole. They don't chew them up first. He swallows the whole frog. So the mouth slowly goes around the frog. So the front of the frog was still sticking out. Then a little fly went by the nose of the frog and his tongue shot out to catch the little fly. Who is the frog? Who is the snake? That's the question. The snake is time. And the frog is the living entity who is trying to enjoy all kinds of opportunities that fly by his nose. And choop, there he goes, although he's already half eaten by the snake, depending on the age, right? Let's say 35, 40, that means half eaten, right? Only 25, not yet half, but at least the hind legs are already half digested, right? You know, 75, you can imagine the eyes are still sticking out and the tongue, right? And the rest is in the snake, but this little bit is sticking out, still catching flies, right? Yes. 80, you know, you don't even see the frog anymore, but sometimes the tongue is coming out. Like this, the serpent of time is doing its work. It's doing it very silently, and only sometimes we notice it. No, I'm not getting old. Well, maybe a little bit, you know, but not really. Right? But sometimes we notice it. Boy, I'm getting old. Right? It is a fact. Time does its work, and sooner or later, every living entity will have to experience that. So, the yogi, he is interested in uplifting himself in consciousness. That is his business. Now, the whole exercise of this particular yogi who went in a box trying to protect himself from this illusory energy is really too much work. It's not required. Right? There's an easier system. That system is just eating Govindas. By eating in Govindas, the same result can be attained as what the yogi attained. But because it is an other type of yoga, it is not necessary that one locks himself away from the world. Right? No, one can stay in the world. The idea that this world is dangerous because one can become entangled in matter, and if one becomes entangled in matter, and if at the time of death one is still attached to matter, then what happens? Then one goes out of the present body, and then one's desires pull one back into a new body. And again, one has to go through the whole thing. Be a kid again, not knowing anything again, going to school again, right? And just waiting till finally you're grown up. Right? You can't wait till you're grown up, and it takes so long. Finally you're grown up, and then already, then again the whole thing. Then you have to work, and so many troubles. So, it is said that this cycle of birth and death it's better to avoid it. So yoga is actually a process by which one can conquer the influence of the material energy and one can rise above and come to a different level of consciousness. Consciousness is everything. I have one example which describes the nature of consciousness and how and what a difference it makes. There was a boy. He was in love with this beautiful girl. Oh, she was so wonderful. So, you know, he did the whole thing. He bought the roses, right? And he went into the street where she lived to visit her house, and it was called Paradise Lane, right? Paradise Lane. And while he was there, it was like music was playing, and he walked into Paradise Lane, and he rang the doorbell, and ding dong, ding ding, ding ding, ding dong, singing a song. She's coming down. He heard her footsteps coming closer to the door. The door opened, and there were the flowers, and she said, "What are you doing here?" Right? "Oh, not you." And the flowers spontaneously cracked their heads, hung down, you know. And he felt his heart broke on the spot, and he turned away dejected. And when he walked through the street, it was no longer Paradise Lane, right? But it was Demon's Alley, you know, like filled with, on Devil's Corner, right? And he just saw deep, dark, gray houses and angry dogs and nasty people, and barbed wire, and didn't know how quick he could get out of that street. Right? So in this way, we can see how consciousness can make all the difference. Consciousness makes the difference. Hmm? One says the cup is half empty, the other one says it's half full, you know. So both are right. That is a fact. So in this way, consciousness makes the difference. So the purpose of yoga is to uplift the consciousness. That's it. It's not to kind of, you know, stretching and all these things. Sooner or later, we get old anyway. Then all your stretching won't help. But it's to uplift the consciousness. Now, the perfect consciousness is described to be Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness is that consciousness where we understand how everything is connected with each other, how we understand the origin of everything. Mm. Generally, people, they have a little piece of the puzzle. Einstein had his piece, right? And another scientist has another piece. And then there's a great priest. He has a piece of the puzzle. So many people stand up for something great, you know. And many great men have come in the history of the world and made a contribution. And they all made a contribution with a piece of the puzzle. But who understands the whole picture, right? The whole picture. So you may have a little piece of the puzzle, and it looks like a lotus leaf. Wow, beautiful. Yes, and then someone else may have another lotus leaf, and gradually, as the puzzle begins to unfold, someone has a peacock feather, and again, it goes further and further, until finally, we get the moon-like face of Krishna. Right? Then the puzzle is complete. Then we understand that Krishna is the origin of everything. He is very beautiful and attractive. His color is blackish, right? But not ordinary blackish. Rather, it is a spiritual color, blackish, which cannot be compared to any color in the world. Interesting enough, in the spiritual world, the residents have many different colors. Some are white, some are yellow, some are pinkish, some are bluish, and some are greenish, and that is all possible. But Krishna is most wonderful, because the color of Krishna is compared to a rain cloud. In Vrindavan, the residents of Vrindavan, I was there for some time, and during the rainy season you see these big dark clouds coming in, and then when the clouds are getting heavy and full of water, they go in front of the sun. Now the sun in India is so strong, and at that season it is so powerful, it burns, and the light, the glare of that sun is so bright that even if the dark cloud goes in front of the sun, the light shines right through the sun, and the sun shines right through the cloud, and the result is that the blue from the sky behind reflects in that cloud. At that moment, when the residents of Vrindavan see that, they call out, "Sham!" That's the color of Krishna, like a rain cloud, but at the same time so effulgent. Krishna, because he's so effulgent, some who go into meditation, you ask them, "What do you see?" And they say, "I see a light." Right? Of course, someone told Prabhupada like this. Someone was chanting Hare Krishna and said, "When I chant Hare Krishna, I see a red light." Prabhupada said, "Don't worry. keep on chanting, it will go away. But anyway, some people, they think that the origin of everything is the white light. They've heard of this white light. They've read books about the white light. You can buy in New Age stores all kinds of far-out books about the white light. Right? And they think, this is it, you know. Psh, white light. I am white light. I am light. You are light. And I am me. And you are he. And we are all together. And, you know, it's all one, this, that, and light. And, whew, wow, it's all fantastic. Okay. We have no problem with that. It is all that, but it is still more than that. Because behind that light, Hiranmayena Patrena Satyasya Pitam Mukham, is the face of Krishna. That's behind the light. But the light is so bright that one cannot see the face of Krishna behind. So, Krishna is really the purpose of all yoga. If one understands that, then one is very fortunate. So the Bhagavad Gita makes that very clear. So it's not that all these kinds of yogas that are coming from India to the West are concoctions. They are not. They actually have their roots in Vedic scriptures. And when someone teaches us different asanas, that is bona fide. In a sense, it's actually an ancient science. But the purpose of that science is to become Krishna conscious, to become conscious of Krishna. So, trance means to think of Krishna. Krishna is a person, and he is the, but he simultaneously has also his unlimited energies. So, nowadays, that's not so fashionable, to think about a personal God. It used to be. Here in the West, you know, everyone used to think God lives on the clouds together with his angels and his sheep and the shepherds and all these things, right? They're there and, like, you know, on the little clouds, and it's all happening like that. But now everyone, you know, has done a little tour with SAS or another airlines and has seen, you know, I didn't see anything up there, right? No God. Yeah? Did anyone see? In Bombay, they asked Neil Armstrong, the famous astronaut, if, since he had gone much higher than the clouds, if maybe he had seen God up there. And Neil Armstrong said, well, you know, folks, I'm really sorry, but I didn't meet him anywhere, you know. I guess he had just gone to the other side, you know. But where I was, he wasn't there. So, but it is a fact that he is there. Michelangelo painted God also sitting on a cloud, looking down, a little heavy one, right? Ready to catch, you know, the sinners of this world. So is he really like that? Krishna's not like that. He doesn't sit on a cloud just waiting to catch us. You know, he's got other things to do. Krishna is in the spiritual world, and the spiritual world is a little higher than Neil Armstrong went. You still have to fly a little higher than you can go in a tin can. You know, you have to actually, you need a special spiritual airplane to go there if you want to go by flight. So, bookings can be made, right, after this lecture. We have a little travel agency. Anyone who wants to come with us on a tour to the spiritual world, I'll show you the whole package. You know, of course, it's not a simple journey. It's going to cost you something, but not that bad. It's a very adventurous trip. There's a lot of stops on the way. So, you know, don't miss this opportunity. People were used to think of going to the moon, but we don't bother with that. We'll go to the spiritual world. So anyone who wants to book, book now. It may be your last chance, you know. It happens to be on sale today. Just see. This was the commercial. But to get serious again, although the commercial is pretty serious too, speak to us after the program. Krishna, he is indeed existing as a person, but a little higher than the clouds. the Christian religion, where as science was making progress, and as science was reaching above the clouds and said, no God to be found here, then the Christian priests, they quickly withdrew and said that, well, actually, that's all just metaphorical, that's just for the simple people, so they believe, but in reality that's just a mythology. The real thing you have to understand, God is the supreme intelligence. So they had created then a nice impersonal image of God. In this way, Christianity lost its original personal approach to God and changed it for an impersonal one. In India, the history is quite similar. There also, I'll save you the details, but in principle, there also, from a personal concept of God, it went to the impersonal. And so many were just sitting there, after that, you know, they felt a little lighter in the head. And after doing it again, you know, you kind of feel definitely like floating. I'm already dizzy. So it certainly brought people all kinds of spiritual experiences. Did you try it too? Oh, yes. Ecstatic, wasn't it? Hoo-hoo. I used to. Before I got involved with Hare Krishna, in my hometown, there was this center, you know, and up in the top of the building, they had a big white room. And in that white room on the wall, they had a big meditation symbol, and we would just sit there, from our toes, you know, and it's like, whew. They thought it was very powerful. So, it fits right in with modern times, isn't it? Impersonalism. Oh, yes, impersonalism is very, very modern. We live now in big cities and nobody knows each other. We're all strangers. We just look into space. Nobody says nothing to nobody. Like on a Dutch train, right? I'm from Holland. On a Dutch train, it's much different than an Indian train. Or an African train, I mean, like, you know. In a Dutch train, especially in the winter, it gets dark early, like here, you know, 4 o'clock, it's dark, and people sit in the train coming back from work, and there is the window is dark, right? So nobody in the train speaks with each other, and nobody looks at each other, but they look in the window, right? And they look in the window, and in the window they look at each other, and sometimes you look in the window, you see someone's eyes are directed to you, and you catch the eyes, and quickly the eyes turn away, looking upwards or something. You know, very impersonal. Very impersonal. So impersonalism is there on all fronts. We'd rather... We have machines, we deal with machines, you know, like now so many machines, like, I don't know how it's here, but also I saw in Holland that they finished all the people selling tickets for the trains. There's only machines now in the whole country. You cannot buy any ticket from any person anymore, only from a machine. So like this, more machines, less people, I'm also a machine, and the universe is a big machine. We have a mechanistic idea, and there's planets floating about in orbits, space, 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 and we are in that also as beings in the universe and all energies, and we are one with those energies, one, 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 the music is becoming like that, boom, 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 boom. House music and all kinds of varieties, you know. Impersonalism is actually become a fashion. It's become a fashion. Now, of course, the funny thing about fashion is that when you're in the middle of a fashion, you can't see it's fashion. You think it's normal. It's like if we look at the costumes of a few hundred years ago, we're laughing. You know, we see these men with big wigs on, you know, walking around like that. And see, in some hot countries, you know, like south of France, you see them like with the wigs on, dripping, like sweating, you know, with these hot big wigs on. I know the experience because there was a time when we Hare Krishna sometimes used to put on wigs to sell things door to door. And I have also had one. I had a blonde curly one of all wigs. It was too much. A big blonde curly wig I had like this. And I was sweating under that thing. I had a red face in the summer. And then I used to knock, ring on doorbells and try to sell something because we had to live, right? We had to have some money. We didn't know how to do it. So we were selling these things, and then I sometimes saw people look at my hair. And I used to stand on my toes then, you know? And then I would see their eyes would still follow my hair. Then I knew, get out of here quick, before they pull the wig off. Anyway, anxiety. No more. We are finished with this. But what to do? Everyone thought we were crazy. No one wanted to help us, and we had no money. So, you know, we had to do something. All right. So that's what we did. Anyway, I was speaking about fashion, right? And that the fashion of a few hundred years ago looks ridiculous now, but was completely normal then. Everyone thought it was normal. There was a time when they thought the earth was flat and that you would fall off. Now we think this is childish, but in those days they thought this is serious, watch out, you know. And the proof was that anyone who sailed far away had never returned. That was the proof, see? So that was logical, there was proof, and everyone knew that's a fact. The earth is flat, and if you don't watch out, you fall off. So fashion is such a thing. So right now it's a fashion to be impersonal and to think everything is impersonal and that we live in a machine. And, of course, it feels a little difficult, and that's why a lot of people need a psychiatrist. Because it is a little strange to be a person and to think that everything is impersonal, isn't it? Because we are persons. A person means he is a unique individual, that no two people are the same. That's a person. Well, if I look in this room, it's really like that. Everyone's different. Put my glasses on. Even twins, you might say, well, there are twins, but even twins are different. There are differences. One is a round watch, another one a square watch. But there may be other differences too, you know. There may be. Even in the character, you can see differences. After a while, you can easily see which one is which, if you see them for a long time. So, we are all individuals, persons. Everyone's different. Nobody's the same. So why do we think that all this impersonal, fashion, it conflicts with our nature? So we feel a little, oh, it's okay, I mean, I have no problem with it, you know. It's okay, she's already quiet. So the impersonal feature doesn't feel good to us. It makes us cry, yeah? You know. I would also cry if I'm just around just impersonal things. You need some personal relationships, right? Then when you cry, when some person cares for you, then you become quiet again. Just see. Isn't it? It's like that. So everyone needs personal relationships. So the fact that we are persons and that we have a personal relationship makes it perfectly logic that behind everything, behind all the energy, is a person. And if, anyway, even from a logical, philosophical point of view, if we say that God is only intelligence, he is energy, right? He's all that. But he cannot be a person. We can't limit him. How can we? If we can be a person, can he not be a person? Of course he can be. He can be anything that we are and more, right? He's unlimited. So whatever is possible, he can be that. So therefore, it is clear that he is a person also. So Krishna is the personal manifestation of God.
So in India, people accept debts. They say, yes, 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 Swamiji, this is very nice. Yes. So good. But you see, Swamiji, that the origin of this person is, of course, the impersonal. Yes, yes. You see? And in this way, there has been quite a debate, you know, going on for quite some time. But the Bhagavad Gita, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, he doesn't like that so much. He said, Ava janati mam mudha manusim tanamasritam. He says, mudas, they think that I've just assumed this form. So, muda means donkey or an ass, right? The literal translation means ass. I'm sorry, I don't want to use heavy words, but Krishna doesn't need to be polite because he's the Supreme Lord, so he can do whatever he likes. He uses the word. He says, muda. A muda thinks that I have assumed this human form. He also says, avyaktim vyaktimapana manyate mama buddhya. He says, whoever thinks that the personal form comes from the impersonal energy, he has no brains. Abuddhya. So, it's pretty clear from the Bhagavad Gita that there is, that Krishna is the origin. And we read it in other scriptures, Isvara Parama Krishna Satsidananda Vigraha. So Krishna is the origin of everything, and his energies come from him. First there's the person, and then the energies. So now we got the full picture, right? So here we are playing with the energies. When we are kids, we are playing with toys, you know. We would be driving on this floor, say, oh, such a nice road here, you know, right? And we play with dolls when we are kids, like that, you know. We have different ways of staying, of playing around with the energies. When we grow up, we still play with toys, a man hanging on a glider, you know, or someone with a sailing yacht, pulling and wind is pushing and he's playing, wow, it's exciting, or we're playing with other energies, you know, some lady is playing with a dress. See my power. Yes, and blink, blink. Wow, what was that? And she's loving to play with the energies. So there are many energies to play with. And we keep on playing and playing and playing with different energies. Speed, you know, money, money, the power of cash in your hand. Right? Or just power in general, political power in charge of a country. You know, the President of the United States is considering that he has got the top job, that he is the most important man on the planet. I am the number one man on the planet. Wow. Right? Of course, we don't think like that. Yes, so like this, one can play around. One can play with power. One can play politics. One can play and play and play and play with Krishna's energies. But if you want, you can also play with Krishna. Personally. Yes, it's possible. He plays with us, already he's doing it now. He's playing all kinds of games with us. You didn't think it was happening by chance, did you? When the other day you found that money on the street and, you know, you thought it was luck? Forget it. Krishna put it there for you. He's playing with you. Just see. Krishna is the supreme controller. Not a blade of grass moves without his will. He's doing everything, Krishna. Yes, so in this way, Krishna's playing with us, but we can't see. But we can play with Krishna also. Because Krishna can be brought under control. It's not only that he is the controller, that there is a God sitting on a throne, and we are his slaves, and we have to just fall at his feet and worship him forever. Never, never. Surrender, surrender. Or, okay, suffer, suffer. All right, I'll surrender. And like this, that we have to become his slaves? No. In fact, a devotee can attract Krishna by his service, and to such a point that even Krishna becomes under the control of his devotee. Now, this Bhagavad Gita is wrapped up, but I'm going to unwrap it for a sec. Oh, it doesn't have the picture. Anyway, it's one of the editions without picture. But we have seen many times the edition of the picture on front of Bhagavad Gita where Arjuna is in the chariot and Krishna is his chariot driver. That means Krishna is the driver, he's his servant. Yeah? And Arjuna is telling him, go left, go right. So this is the proof that the devotee can control Krishna. So if you want to experience it, to do a little service for Krishna, then he will be attracted. Then we can experience this whole reality. So whatever I've said may sound a little ethereal to some. It may sound a little incomprehensible. It may sound a little dreamy. But anyone who wants to make it practical can simply engage in some devotional service. And the most practical form of devotional service that anyone can engage in is this chanting of Hare Krishna. And by chanting this mantra, one can very soon, in a practical way, experience these things. Then one can see Krishna, and one can play with Krishna. So that is Krishna consciousness. Real Krishna consciousness means that we can see Krishna face to face as much as we can see each other right now. And that will be the result of for anyone who is chanting the Maha Mantra. Okay, maybe there are some questions or some comments from some of the devotees.
The verse it was saying step by step, Vaitelya's approach first. Now this is describing the journey of the Buddha. How can this be described in our process? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Step by step is this, is that in this world there are two types of people, those who are atheists and those who have some, who believe that there is a God. So the atheists, they are not very happy, they're suffering. I mean, if we are just made of a bunch of chemicals, right, and if that's all we are, chemicals, then one day these chemicals are going to disintegrate. That's not so nice, is it? So the atheistic view is not so nice. So therefore, when one has suffered in the atheistic conception of life, then one may consider that, well, maybe there is something after all. And then one has some idea about something. But it doesn't go much further. A little faith. So eventually one's vague concept may, by one's sincere desire, and develop a little further until one meets the devotees. When one meets the devotees, then one gets a better understanding of what it's all about, and one begins to understand the process of devotional service. Then devotional service is very practical. Many people who believe in God, right, in the world, they may say, well, he's in heaven, or he is somewhere in that other world, he is, it doesn't matter in what culture you see, but they always describe him as he's in another world. He's invisible and he's in another world. And it seems that yoga, meditation, or religion, in general, is just meant to cover that distance to that other world. And that only when you succeed in that, that you get some experience of Krishna. But bhakti yoga is different. Bhakti yoga can be done right here. It is a yoga which is very practical. In bhakti yoga, one doesn't need to try to see Krishna somewhere far away because he's here right now. We may see him or we may not see him, but we can serve him here right now with whatever is here. And when we start doing that, then very soon we will see him more and more and more. First indirectly, present in everything, and then gradually we'll start perceiving him directly. So how can we serve him here? by just using whatever we have for Krishna. We can use our car. Beep, 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 beep. Just use my telephone for a second. Yes, hello. Okay, yes, sure. Let us just do that in the service of Krishna. Why not? Good idea. I can use everything. Computer, you know, sure, for Krishna. Anything can be used for Krishna. So there is no need to move, no need to go live in the forest or to go to the Himalayas, to give up the world. Stay in Stockholm in your little flat or whatever it is, right? Keep your, what do they call them again, Volvo. You know, it's okay. One can have all these things, right? Home sweet home, you know. Sit behind your double glass and look at the winter and so forth and, you know, and enjoy. There is no problem. Just add Krishna to your life. That's all. Just add Krishna in that life. No need to change life. A few things have to go, but you can still go to the supermarket. What a relief, isn't it? Yes, you can. You don't have to stop going to the supermarket. You just go to the supermarket. There's only certain things you cannot put in your shopping carts. No, no fish. Ooh, all these cans with fish. Nope, they don't go in. The meat section, don't even go in there. Forget it, you know. You wouldn't want to. Ooh, horrible. There you don't go. The beer, nope, no beer in the cart. The fruit juices, yes, oh nice, fruit juices. The fruits, put them in, the vegetables, no problem, the nuts, the vegetarian cheeses, and by the time you get to the cash register, you have a shopping cart full like everybody else, and it feels okay. You feel, in fact, a little better. And I tell you, you will feel a lot better when you get the final bill, you know, from the lady, because you see you're a lot cheaper than the other people who've loaded up their carts with fish and meat and all other expensive items. Ah, so there are many arguments in favor of bhakti yoga. One can continue his regular life. Just a few things have to go out. So no need to shave your head, no need to put on a pink dress. Of course, if you like pink, you can put on pink. We are not against that. But the point is, we can live our own natural life and add Krishna consciousness to us. So step by step, we introduce Krishna in our life. And in that way, everything will come. So that's what step by step means for us. It's good. Okay, so I'll come back one more time tomorrow. What time is that? 4 in the afternoon. So hope you'll also, if you liked it today, we'll come back tomorrow, and there will be a big feast served also tomorrow because it's Sunday, and on Sunday there's always a feast, and I'm sure here it's good. Because the cooks are good. So I think tomorrow is worth coming. I'll definitely come. So I thank you very much for your attention. And see you tomorrow. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.